Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
The North Carolina General Assembly wrapped up its short session this week. The Republican majority succeeded in passing an adjusted budget ahead of the fiscal year. The GOP also put six proposed constitutional amendments onto the fall ballot, including measures to cap the state's personal income tax at 7% and requiring a photo ID for in-person voters. And lawmakers rejected four of Governor Roy Cooper's nominees for various posts. Joining me to discuss the bruising final week of the short session are Becky Gray, Senior Vice President with the conservative John Locke Foundation, and Billy Ball, Managing Editor at the progressive NC Policy Watch.
Happy to be here.
Becky, good to see you.
Good to see you as always. Thank you.
Republican lawmakers in control of the General Assembly accomplished the main task of the short legislative session that is coming to a close. Budget adjustments passed above Governor Roy Cooper's veto ahead of the new fiscal year. But this session was marked by a lot more: constitutional amendments, veto overrides, and perhaps most indicative of the partisan divide in Raleigh, rejections of gubernatorial nominees. Becky, would you call Republican rejections of Cooper nominees like former Public Safety Secretary Brian Beatty for a Superior Court judgeship, Robert Harris for the State Industrial Commission, and some Board of Education appointees or nominees, is this a new low for collegiality in Raleigh?
I don't think it's a new low. I think it's an accountability thing. You know, the governor has his folks that he wants to put in those places. The General Assembly had problems with them for some reason. I'll tell you what I was kind of puzzled with, Rusty. I mean, why didn't they have a conversation beforehand? You know, why didn't the governor come over and say, you know, here are the folks I'm thinking about nominating for these positions. What do you think? Anybody got any problems with this? Get some feedback if there needed to be adjustments. If the General Assembly had said before the vote was taken, this is somebody we're just not going to be able to endorse. We're not going to be able to confirm. I think all of this could have been avoided. The big show could have been avoided. And, you know, I think embarrassment for those nominees who were rejected by the General Assembly.
Well, that was a criticism leveled, at least by one lawmaker, at the governor, saying he could have paved the way better. But, Billy, I mean, four rejections. At least from the tweets I saw from some Democratic lawmakers, this was not business as usual.
You know, I'll agree with Becky for about a half a second here. I don't think it's a new low either. I think it's a low that we've hit several times now when it comes to debate on gubernatorial nominees. This is not the first time that we've seen nominees either slowed down or outright rejected on partisan lines. And you bring up the State Board of Education. There were nominees of the former governor of Purdue that never got their day, that sat there lingering, and eventually we saw Governor Pat McCrory fill those seats. You know, so it's not unprecedented, I would think, but I think it was fascinating yesterday to see some of these votes where Republicans did not provide any explanation as to why they were voting against these nominees. And on that grounds, it seemed like it was purely partisan, and I think that, and obstructionist. And I think progressives right now are rightly angry, not over these kinds of issues or obstructionism at the state level, but also at the national level when we see the president getting another Supreme Court justice.
So. Well, rejections of nominees are not the only things raising ire, at least among progressives and other critics of the Republican leadership. Voters will get to weigh in on proposed constitutional amendments: the right to hunt and fish, lowering the cap on personal income tax to 7%, photo ID requirement for in-person voting at North Carolina polls. So, Billy, will putting these issues on the fall ballot have the effect that Republicans hope for of drawing right-leaning voters to the polls?
I think it is a good question, and it gets exactly to the point of why we're discussing many of these things that we're going to see on the ballot. And of the things that I do trust about this legislature, I trust that they know how to galvanize their voters. I think that's one of the things that we've seen over the years when we had the Amendment 1 vote to enshrine discrimination against the LGBT community in our Constitution. At its most cynical, I believe that was also an attempt to galvanize their voters. You know, when we're talking about the amendment to consider hunting and fishing rights, I don't think people believe that hunting and fishing rights are imperiled in this state. I think it's an attempt to get their voters out to the polls, and it also shows perhaps some nervousness about the upcoming election. And we'll see how it plays out. But I do think it is their intent to get those voters out. But I also think that they know that progressive voters are particularly motivated right now.
Becky, turning to the tax cap amendment, Republicans had to scramble to get that through. There were some Republicans who I think were concerned about spending in the future on education and other needs to raise revenue. They got it up to 7%. Was that a big turnaround for Republicans?
Well, there was certainly a lot of discussion about it. Of course, I think it's important to realize or recognize that right now in our state constitution, there is a cap on personal income. It's at 10%. So the whole discussion of this was, should it be lower? The original proposal was 5.5%. Important to recognize too that our current personal income tax rate is 5.25%. So it would have been, that cap would have been above where we are now. After some discussion going back and forth, and I think, you know, you're right, some members had concerns about, I don't think when fiscal conservatives are in charge, there is as much concern about sort of this breakaway spending, out of control spending. It's if the tide turns back, how do you keep that cap on spending and taxes? To be honest with you, I would have rather have seen a cap on spending. Now, there's two sides to this, the taxing and then the spending. I would have rather seen, or in addition to, seen a constitutional amendment to cap the spending. But it was something that there was a lot of discussion. They ended up at 7%, as you mentioned. I think it's an important discussion to have. I think it's going to be fun between, as a fiscal conservative and sort of a budget nerd and a tax nerd, I think it's going to be fun during this referendum period, that while voters will be making the decision of how to vote in this in November, to have that discussion about what it means when you have a high tax rate, what it means to the economy. So I'm looking forward to that discussion. And as you and Billy both have alluded to, you know, voters get to decide this. So I think that's another important point to consider. If Republicans are trying to motivate their voters to come to the poll to vote in favor of these things, it seems to me that you turn that around, wouldn't progressives and liberals and Democrats be motivated to come to the poll to vote against it?
Billy, 7%, a little more palatable for progressives?
I don't know that, but I think that most progressives and not just progressives, people who believe in good governance would say that there are very legitimate concerns about tying lawmakers' hands when it comes to the budget. And you will hear, as we have already heard, public school advocates making it very clear that tying lawmakers' hands financially is probably not a good practice or a good approach.
A hastily crafted bill on its way to the governor now would restore early voting on the final Saturday before Election Day. And that has proven, by data, been proven to be a popular day for African-American early voters. Billy, is that an about-face for Republicans?
It's interesting. I think that was a surprise to some yesterday, and it was certainly, I think, the right decision. I think it was shameful that we were talking about it in the first place, to be quite frank, because I think that we have seen efforts underway to place obstacles in the way of certain voters. It has certainly seemed that way, regardless of how it is debated on the floor. It's not something that lawmakers are going to say out loud, but I think we're here to say that to speak the truth about the impacts of these kinds of things, and they would have disproportionately impacted people of color, some of our lower income voters, some of our young voters. And I don't think it's a coincidence, and I don't think many people believe it's a coincidence, that those are voters who tend to lean to the other party.
And Becky, we should say the first version of the early voting bill had removed that final Saturday, moved it back to the Friday before Election Day. This bill now restores that. Is this a result of true reflection on the part of David Lewis and other Republican lawmakers?
I think it is. I mean, that's what I heard. I mean, I was down there at the building, attended the Rules Committee when this bill came up, and it was a little bit of a surprise. I mean, you know, to many of us who were, I mean, we'd heard the discussion, heard the arguments, the pleas to restore it. And this further expands early voting. I think it's also important to remember that what they did is they expanded early voting, moving it from beginning on a Thursday to beginning on a Wednesday. They did do away with that last Saturday. There was still a Saturday that was available for people to vote. It wasn't that, I mean, we've heard some progressives, well, you know, people of color, low-income people, young people like to vote on Saturday. There was still a Saturday in there for people who choose to vote that way. But they also extended the hours and made it uniform, which that really makes sense to me. I think it was a good decision to do that. And, you know, it just gives, I think, you know, the more opportunity that we give people to vote, the better. That's what they did.
And it should be pointed out that the legislation restoring the Saturday restores it for 2018. It says nothing about beyond that, and I think that some lawmakers are concerned about what comes next.
Well, and we may revisit this. I mean, one of the questions have been from local governments, because they're the ones that have to pay for these early voting sites, and there's been a little bit concern of the cost associated with that. So I think that what this will do is it will give us an opportunity after the November election. Hopefully we'll have lots and lots of people voting, just to look at it, do a cost-benefit analysis and see, you know, what's working. Maybe do we need to tweak it again? I think that's healthy. I think that's the way we should be doing things.
Something else that will be happening after the November elections, lawmakers are coming back to Raleigh. They passed a resolution. They'll be coming back late November to work on enabling legislation that will bring some clarity to the constitutional amendments they hope will be approved by voters. Becky, were Democrats and other critics right in saying measures like the photo ID requirement should not have been put into constitutional amendments with so much legislating left to do to determine how they'll be enforced?
I think, I mean, this is a fine line, and there's a balance there. I think when you're talking about amending the Constitution, you need to be short and concise in what you do. And we see this all through state government. You know, the General Assembly puts things in places. They authorize local governments to implement it. They authorize agencies to do it. I mean, this is not unheard of to put this in the Constitution and just short and sweet. You know, do you think we should have a require a photo ID when you go to vote? And then if yes, then they will come back with the enabling legislation to work out those details. And I would hope, and our organization, and I'm guessing Billy's organization too, would be between now and then, if it passes, to make some recommendations on what this ought to look like. And that's where, because it's in legislation, we'll all have an opportunity to weigh in on that.
Billy, short and concise or too vague?
I think that I don't know how we can expect voters to cast a ballot on something in it and wait for legislators to figure out those details later. That's putting a lot of trust in legislators. And I don't know that this General Assembly's leadership has established a base of trust in terms of their intent and their follow through. So I don't know how voters can be expected to do something like that. And we heard a lot of arguments about this in the legislature in the last few days and arguments that should have been made. You know, I think that these details should be put before voters as soon as possible. I think voters should have time to debate the pros and cons and come up with some sort of reasoned decision. And I don't think that this process, and we've talked a lot about process this session, more so probably than any other year that I've seen. Just the, you know, processes that limit public input that have limited a lot of good debate. I don't think that this process is a good one.
Billy Ball, managing editor at NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray, senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Thank you both very much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Rusty.
Thank you.